That doesn't mean that any of the other active shooters suffered the same thing.
That's unhelpful, said Kimberly.
It is, isn't it? I said. I can scan some of the basic textbooks we've got back at the Folly, but really, they're not that useful either. At least I haven't found them that useful. Kimberly nodded and stared at her empty coffee cup.
You know, the coffee in this place is terrible, she said.
So we walked further up Uxbridge Road until we found somewhere with decent coffee, and Kimberly finally told me what she was doing in the UK.
Now, since I have become the Bureau's go-to girl for things both English and supernatural, I have been tasked to try and smooth the repatriation of my fellow citizens.
She gave me an arch look.
Those that are still alive, back to the United States of America, where they belong.
You could just leave them to us, I said. They're facing some serious charges, false imprisonment, possession of a firearm with intent.
Intent of what?
Just general intent at the moment, I said. Kimberly said that if it were down to her, she'd be happy to let them enjoy Her Majesty's hospitality, but there was the pesky detail of their quasi-official status and the US government being loath to rinse out its undies in the British courts. In order to facilitate a happy outcome, she'd be sent over with a grab bag of low-level secrets and concessions to tempt the palate of the British security establishment.
Not to mention save the taxpayers some money, she said.
Did it work? I asked.
Yes and no, said Kimberly. Everybody agreed in principle.
But
only if your boss says yes, said Kimberly. My boss? Yes. Nightingale. Do you have another boss?
No, I thought, but I didn't think his influence stretched that far.
Did they say why?
I asked.
They said there was an arrangement, she said.
Of course there is, I thought. And you want me to persuade Nightingale, I said.
Would you?
Said Kimberly.
Because that would be swell.
So what do you plan to offer us? Kimberly smiled.
I thought you'd never ask, she said,
and pulled out a USB pen and put it on the table between us.
I've got the names, the organizational structure, and the history of the Virginia Gentleman's Company, and, most importantly, details of what got them over here in the first place.
And what was that? I asked. Kimberly said that she had never driven out to Fort Meade, Maryland, to gaze upon the collection of gargantuan modernist blocks that made up the headquarters of the National Security Agency. But she liked to imagine it a honeycomb of bland little cubicles. All the cubicles would be almost identical, but to the trained eye there would be subtle variations of status and purpose. Those cubicles tasked with monitoring global communications for unsuspecting terrorist suspects would have bigger, flatter monitors, nicer desk calendars, maybe the ones with a humorous daily proverb, and first crack at the sandwich trolley when it came past.
How much sleep have you had recently?
I asked.
Bear with me,
said Kimberly, and described the cubicles farthest from the canteen, the ones with the worrying smell from the pipes overhead, whose inhabitants walked the furthest to find their cars at home time. This was where the information gathered from open sources on the internet, Twitter, eBay, Facebook, Tumblr and the like, was processed. It was flagged by machine, of course, but some poor schlub still had to go through the items and decide which organ of the state might want to know who was selling a used pink bathrobe for suspiciously large sums of money, possible money laundering, or a rare mint snow globe, potential hazardous material transfer. There was a list, Kimberly imagined, and in an obscure subsection of that list, a section that had not been properly updated since George Bush was president, was the government contractee Alderman Technical Solutions, a.k.a. the Virginia Gentleman's Company. So when the right flag was triggered, the cubicle jockey dutifully notified an organization which should have been taken off that list, ever since an unspecified disaster in Fallujah had got them struck off another list, that of approved contractors. I asked what happened in Fallujah, but Kimberly shook her head.
That information was so redacted that I only know it happened in Fallujah because someone missed a reference in the document authorizing the redaction, she said.
She couldn't even discover what they were doing in Iraq, although there were references to something called area shade suppression and tech sub. Whatever it was they were doing, Kimberly didn't think it was very successful, because their contract was terminated in 2009, with 2 years left to run. Given the low, low standards for success applied to private military contractors in Iraq, the fuck-up that got them fired must have been spectacular. Not that Kimberly used the words fuck-up, you understand. She didn't seem surprised that they were still tangled up in the Byzantine coils of the American intelligence establishment. "People still know people who know people," she said. "You should know that." I asked what she thought had triggered the cubicle jockey to contact them in the first place. What had brought Alderman Technical Solutions across the pond? "Your late friend Christina Chorley tried to sell something called the Wild Ledger on eBay, with a reserve price of 20 grand," she said. "We knew they were after that," I said, and wondered why Krukart hadn't just paid for it, probably cheaper than flying all his guys over and smuggling their guns in, not to mention hiring the SUVs with the suitably sinister tinted windows.
"Ah, but did you know about something called the Mary Engine?" said Kimberly. "She was selling that on eBay, too."
She showed me a picture taken from eBay on her tablet. A dense cube of steel and brass gears.
"A difference engine?" I asked. "That's the advantage of having the NSA looking at something like this," said Kimberly. "Those guys know the difference between their difference and analytical engines, and apparently this is neither."
I asked what they thought it was.
"They couldn't lift enough detail from the photographs to determine what it was supposed to do, but they think it's genuinely Victorian. Mid-1840s, they reckon. In fact, if you run it down and you want to generate some goodwill with the NSA, you might want to send it over as a gift." "You think I'm going to need goodwill with the NSA?"
"Peter," said Kimberly, "the way your life is going, you're going to need all the goodwill you can get."
There were other items of interest, too. A 1920s anthology of Victor Bartholomew's work on spirits, which I recognized from a particularly tedious Latin lesson, and a genuine wizard's staff that had, according to Kimberly, a British Army serial number stenciled along its length. The attached NSA report indicated that there was no coherence to the collection and posited a high probability that it was just that, a collection. Items acquired by an individual who had a high degree of access, but limited understanding.
"Access to what?" I asked.
"They didn't know," said Kimberly.
And where it all came from was a mystery, I thought. Like the changing of the seasons and the tides of the sea. Kimberly and the security arm of the American military industrial complex might not know. But I thought I knew a fox who might. Still, I didn't think there was any point in interviewing Reynard, the wannabe fox, that evening. So I stopped off at Belgravia to brief Nightingale and make multiple backups of the USB pen. Since I was there, I also scanned the files and dumped most of them on the inside inquiry office for assessment and entry into Holmes, including the real names of our American friends. Krukart's name turned out to be Dean Miller, a former reserve captain in the 29th Infantry Division, who had served in Kosovo and Iraq. The 29th was a National Guard unit, but there was no official word on what his day job had been. After leaving the National Guard, he was listed as a consultant with Alderman Technical Solutions. A sour little note, appended by some anonymous security apparatchik, complained that just about everybody at ATS was listed as a consultant. His military record in Iraq was heavily redacted, and what wasn't missing was written in an impenetrable mix of jargon and acronyms. I thought the Met was bad, but they were as nothing compared to the US military. It was going to take some serious Google hours to translate. Captain Dean Miller's compadres all had similar backgrounds in the military and law enforcement, and were noticeably from the American South and Southwest. I wondered if it might be significant, but it was a small sample size. I added hire a civilian analyst to my list of things to go into the growing Word document and moved onto the action list for what was still called Operation Marigold because no one had got round to officially deactivating it yet. I also thought I might as well work my way through the email backlog, which was just as well because an annoyingly unflagged communication from the border agency
informed me that Jeremy Beaumont Jones had flown in from the Bahamas 2 days before his daughter thought he had, which meant he had no alibi for our suspected faceless man incident involving the collapse of his own house, which in turn meant that he was going to have to be TIE'd all over again. And since he was back on our tiger list, that action would fall to me and Nightingale. I stuck it on our long list of urgent actions before heading back to the Folly, and the next morning, I got in bright and early to prepare for the interview. So far, all the earlier interviews with Reynard had gone along the traditional lines of us saying he'd done it and him saying he hadn't, in continuous variations. This is not an uncommon type of interview, and so over the years, police have come up with a number of techniques for breaking the impasse, some of which are still even legal. One of the techniques not outlawed by human rights legislation is the horrid surprise. So I printed up some crime scene images and took them into the interview room with me. We're not allowed to let our prisoners fester. So Reynard was washed and dressed in clean clothes. He was beginning to show a little bit of that fraying around the edges that people get after a couple of nights in the cells. For all the fact that he had villain tattooed on his forehead, Reynard hadn't put in the hours on the judicial stroke criminal coalface I had. Hadn't developed that dogged patience that separates the police and the professional criminal from ordinary members of the public. The fact that he hadn't asked for legal representation was another dead giveaway. "When was the last time you were in Bromley?" I asked, once we'd finished the ceremonial putting of the tapes in the machine and intoned the ritual opening litany of the police interview.
"Bromley?" said Reynard. "What about Bromley?"
"When was the last time you went down there?" He smiled, showing white teeth.
"Can't say that Bromley's the sort of place I rush to embrace. I believe I may have passed through once or twice on my way somewhere else."
"So you never stop off and see your good friend Aidan Burley?"
"Who?"
asked Reynard. "White, middle-class drug dealer," I said. "Your kind of people."
"My kind of people?"
"You know," I said, "pretend criminals love breaking the law, hate taking the consequences."
"I think you've just described the human condition there," said Reynard smugly.
I wasn't going to get a better cue than that. I laid out selected pictures of the Aidan Burley crime scene, saving the artfully framed close-up of his detached face until last.
"Nice," he said.
But behind his casual tone, I caught a whiff of real fear when he asked who it was. "You don't recognize him?" I asked. He said no, shaking his head, but his gaze skittered away from the picture. "That's Aidan Burley," I said, and was surprised by a hint of relief in the set of Reynard's shoulders, either because he didn't know who Aidan was, or merely because it happened to someone else. "What about this?" I asked, and laid down a picture of the Mary engine next to the face. Reynard glanced at it and shrugged.
"What is it?"
"You don't recognize it?"
"Puzzle box?"
he asked. "It's one of the items Christina Chorley was selling on eBay," I said, "along with the item you were trying to sell us."
"On eBay?" said Reynard, too outraged to keep his mouth shut. "The little bitch."
"So you're telling me you didn't know?" I asked, making it a challenge.
"You don't put things like that on eBay," said Reynard. "Everybody knows that."
"Everybody but Christina," I said. "And why not sell stuff on eBay? Everybody else does."
"Because there are some things that are just not done," said Reynard.
"Even by the likes of you."
"Especially by the likes of me," said Reynard. "One does not piss in one's own pool, after all."
"But Christina did, didn't she?" I said. "Not quite the compliant little bunny you were hoping for, was she?"
"Well, they're no fun, Constable, if they don't wriggle a bit under the claw, are they?"
His smile was vulpine and humourless, but now he was talking about things that floated his particular boat, and once they've started doing that, it's just a matter of hopping on board and sailing them down the river. "You like the thrill of the chase, then?" I asked.
"Don't we all?"
I gave him a half shrug that implied I would love to agree with him, but I was constrained by the iron hand of political correctness, which was all it took for Reynard to pick up the paddle
and push us out to midstream. He leaned forward and looked me in the eye.
Most men do, he said, but I've been conditioned not to admit it, even to themselves.
So where do you like to go hunting? I asked.
I don't go looking for them, Peter, he said. They come looking for me.
Presumably with torches and pitchforks.
All the little bunnies do it, said Reynard.
Even the Jermaine Greer wannabes. There they go, backwards and forwards right under your nose, he said, while making sure everything's bouncing away in the most appealing fashion.
It's those little fluffy tails, I said, before I could stop myself, but fortunately Reynard was too deep into his happy place to notice. When little Christina came hop-hopping past, I said, where were you?
The chestnut tree, said Reynard,
which was a famous pub in Marble Arch, where denizens of the Demimonde hung out after doing a hard day's, whatever it is members of the Demimonde do. Zack, the goblin boy, was a periodic patron when he wasn't barred. I'd been in a couple of times to show my face and reassure the community that I was bloody well keeping an eye on them. The thieving gits. It wasn't the sort of place that checked IDs once you were visibly old enough to do a paper round. It also wasn't a pub you wandered into by accident. I pointed this out to Reynard.
She is there with company, he said.
What sort of company?
The deified sort, he said. Or at least one of their offspring.
That's quite a lot of kids, I said. Which one? He hesitated. I suspect he was considering whether he could use the name as a bargaining chip. But then, sensibly, he told me.
Lady Tyre's little girl, he said. Olivia.
And round we go. And where we stop, nobody knows. Chapter 11. Under the Spreading Chestnut Tree. While I was talking to Reynard the Unreliable, Nightingale had popped out with Galeed to extend Jeremy Beaumont Jones and his lovely daughter Phoebe an invitation to help the police with their inquiries. That way, they could run the whole trace, implicate, or eliminate routine, free from the fear that he'd turn up and drop another building on us. And should that or any other equally gruesome thing happen elsewhere while he was with us, we could safely eliminate him from our inquiries. By agreement, we all paused for coffee and scheming, and I asked Galeed what she thought of Phoebe's father.
Actually, he comes across as a bit dim, said Galeed.
A perfectly pleasant fellow, said Nightingale, but not what you'd call a world-class brain.
Which just goes to show that all a degree from Oxford guarantees is that the recipient went to Oxford and turned up for some lessons.
It was a rather poor second at that, said Nightingale.
It seemed that our Mr. Beaumont Jones had been more interested in the Oxford Review than his philosophy, politics, and economics, although he'd also failed to generate a career in cutting topical satire. By the end of the morning, while we'd confirmed that he'd been booked into an exclusive West End hotel, at the time the faceless man was subjecting me to an involuntary swimming lesson with the Americans, we couldn't confirm that he'd actually been in the hotel. Not only did the hotel in question not CCTV its visitors going in and out, discretion being part of the service, but we also hadn't managed to track down Anna, the open-minded blonde, that Jeremy Beaumont Jones claimed to have bunged a grand to for a night of, if not passion, then a really good simulation of it. It didn't help that he couldn't remember which escort agency she'd come from, and had paid in cash, so there was no electronic record. He hadn't booked this woman of negotiable affection on his phone, and there was no record of his making an outside call from the phone in his room. It was a fair bet that someone at the hotel knew exactly which agency represented the young women who came and went, and David Carey had been actioned to take statements from the staff until such time as someone coughed. Once that happened, Carey had declared he was willing to work all hours tracking down escort agencies and taking statements from the girls. That's just how dedicated I am to this job, he said.
Rather him than me, said Galeed. That's a dreary job.
Jeremy Beaumont Jones's alibi for this Monday afternoon's dismemberment in the park was equally porous. But walking around without an alibi was not sufficient grounds to charge either father or daughter. Or at least, it isn't if the suspect has a decent lawyer. I reported Reynard's assertion that Olivia had introduced Christina Chorley to the chestnut tree, and thus to the wonders of the demimonde.
So Olivia McAllister Thames was lying to us, said Sewell. Again.
Somebody's lying, I said, which got me a look of amused indulgence from Stephanopoulos and a snort from Sewell. Of course somebody was lying. We were the police. Somebody was always lying to us.
We have Olivia's girlfriend, said Stephanopoulos. We can always ask her.
No,
said Sewell.
I don't like the way these posh boogers have been pissing us about.
He looked at me and Nightingale.
You know this place?
He asked, meaning the chestnut tree. Nightingale said we did, and Sewell asked if we wouldn't mind popping over and seeing if we couldn't scare up some witnesses who could tell us exactly who had taken whom to where and what they were doing while they were there. Armed with that information, we could then go back into an interview and nail said posh bugger's hands to the table. Metaphorically. Or at least, I hoped he meant metaphorically. You can't take Nightingale to the chestnut tree, because by the time you've walked in the front door, most of the clientele will have run out the back. In fact, on the off chance that this might prove useful one day, I once spent a fun morning trying to find the back door, but to no avail. Rumour was that it opened into a secret subterranean passage, which emerged in the Hyde Park car park. On this visit I did take Galeed, because Sewell was more likely to believe her report than mine. And also, I don't go into the chestnut tree without someone watching my back. The place itself is on a windswept alley in Marble Arch, just short of, and not to be mistaken for, the famous City of Quebec pub. There's no sign on the door, but I've been told that the frame is made of genuine chestnut, cut from the original tree. Inside is a short corridor painted that strange green colour that I assume someone somewhere once persuaded the brewery chains looked wholesome, inviting, and encouraged people to drink to excess. At the end of the corridor, there's a short flight of stairs into the main saloon bar. That's where the actual chestnut tree that presumably gave the pub its name grows out of the wall behind the bar, or rather, doesn't grow because it's been dead for more than 100 years, but its branches spread out in a tangle of bare limbs across the width of the saloon, where they merge with the wooden booths that lurk in the gloom on the other side. Amongst the branches hung dusty iron and glass lamps, holding what I really hoped were fake gas mantles, because using the real ones would have been a bit of a health and safety violation. As I walked in, I caught a whiff of old sweat and hot pie, which might have been bad ventilation or the memory of the crowds that flocked to this end of the Tyburn Road to watch the felons Morris at the end of a rope. Morris being an old word for dance, by the way. It's amazing what you pick up on the job. The woman behind the bar was reassuringly Romanian and didn't flinch when I showed her my warrant card and asked to see the manager. The barmaid explained that she was out getting her lunch, but was expected to be back any minute. In the meantime, would we like a drink? Not being tied to a brewery chain, the Chestnut Tree offered a range of beers in the mid to totally obscure camera range. I had a half of Sandbrook's Junction Ale, just to keep everything friendly and relaxed, you understand, and Galeed had an orange juice and Perrier. It wasn't easy, but we managed to find a table from which we could keep an eye on most of the saloon bar. The tabletop was made from planks of wood that had grown pitted with use and warped with age, possibly before being lacquered with what looked like about half a centimetre of varnish. Despite the ancient beer rings worn in the surface, there was a printed sign in a freestanding iron frame, which requested patrons to preserve the natural beauty of the genuine antique furniture. Thank you. The management. In front of this was a stack of mismatched beer mats. When I had a flick through, I found they were all from different breweries and, where marked, from different pubs. I learnt much later that it was considered good form for patrons to nick beer mats from other pubs and donate them to the chestnut tree.
The really rare ones, from places like Tibet or obscure bars in Abeokuta, ended up pinned to a corkboard behind the stage in the adjoining public bar. "They have live music here," said Gulid, who'd found a leaflet stuffed into the iron frame. "Someone called Shanren Mountain Men Band tonight. Ever heard of them?" I said I hadn't, nor had I heard of Lol Robinson or Laura Marling, who were headlining the coming weekend. Gulid used an apparent interest in the playbill to give the room the once-over. Places like the Chestnut Tree don't get much of a lunchtime crowd. As a rule, the Demimon doesn't work 9 to 5, and so doesn't need to get them in before heading back to the office for a couple of hours of pretending to work. That said, there was a bunch of young men in white shirts in a nearby booth, blue pinstripe jackets flung over the backs of their chairs. Two white, one darker, who might have been Turkish or somewhere equally Mediterranean. They looked like they might work in an office, and I wondered if they knew where they were drinking, or if they'd wandered in by accident. In another booth, two middle-aged women were sitting hunched over their table, so that their faces almost touched. One of them was so pale as to be actually white, with platinum blonde hair swept back behind reassuringly unpointed ears. Her friend was pinker, dark-haired, but with an upward curve to the corner of her eyes that I recognized from some of Edward Linley Sanborn's illustrations for Charles Kingsley's monograph on the taxonomy of the Fae. They must have spotted us watching because they turned to frown at us. I saw their eyes were an unsettling hazel brown. The last time I'd seen eyes that color, I'd been the wrong side of the fairy veil, where I would have stayed if Bev hadn't turned up in a traction engine and given me a lift out. Me and Gulid pretended to be interested in our drinks, because, you know, it's rude to stare. We gave it 10 minutes, enough time for me to finish my half before I went back to the bar and asked after the manageress again. While I did that, Gulid went to stand in the archway that linked the saloon bar with the public bar beyond. We decided that was her best position to cover what we reckoned was the door to the staff area, and also the steps back up to the street. This way, should the manageress or anyone else make a sudden break for it, Gulid could intercept. "She texted me," said the Romanian barmaid, and held up her phone for me to see. "She says she'll be back soon." I looked back and saw that Gulid was talking to a young Chinese guy in a purple open-necked shirt, pre-faded jeans, and leather trainers. He was short but broad-shouldered, his black hair cut with a long fringe. In his left hand, as if glued in place, he carried a slim bamboo and leather case, which I couldn't definitely identify as a sword scabbard, only because of the blue drawstring pouch covering the pommel. He leaned forward, like a bird dipping for a fish, and said something that made Gulid laugh. I saw her eyes flick in my direction, and so did his. He turned to look at me and grinned, and gave me a polite nod and a mocking salute, before turning and walking away. "That was interesting," said Gulid when she joined me. She showed me his card. It was expensive in its simplicity, a good cardstock and superior printing. It read, "Michael Cheung," in black ink, and in smaller print underneath, "Legendary Swordsman," and under that, two clusters of Chinese characters. Gulid was reluctant to hand over the card, so I took a picture and sent it to Postmartin for translation and analysis. "He said that he was the new guy in Chinatown," said Gulid, "and when you had a moment, he'd like you guys to drop in at the usual place for dinner. He said Nightingale would know which place." And it took him 10 minutes to say that. "He also gave his phone number," she said. "You gonna call him?" "Probably," said Gulid.
"And if he draws that sword, you gonna arrest him?"
"That depends, doesn't it?"
said Gulid.
"On what he does with it."
Which was Gulid for mind your own business, but I might have pursued the matter just a little further, in the interest of intracollegial due diligence, if the manageress of the Chestnut Tree hadn't chosen that moment to come back from lunch. She was a white woman in her late 30s with an oval face atop a rather long neck, which she grew her light brown hair long enough to partially disguise. She was wearing a no-nonsense, easy-to-clean light pink blouse with black jeans and nice, comfortable flat shoes. Her eyes were light brown, but even before I got close enough to see the flecks of hazel gold around the iris, I had her pegged as being fayer than the client list of a New Zealand casting agency. Her name was Wanda Poria, and she had the kind of estuary accent that says she could have grown up in London, only her parents moved to the Thames Valley when she was young, presumably to find work in the border mines. "We'd better talk in my office," she said. "We don't want you lot scaring the punters any more than you have already." The staff area was unkempt and vaguely depressing in the way that staff areas always are. The punters get the gloss and the staff get scabby, peeling walls and lockers that looked like they'd been salvaged from a sunken U-boat. The manager's office was just a spare bit of space randomly separated off with drywall and fitted with a long shelf down one side that served as both desk and storage space. There was a serious-looking freestanding safe as far from the door as possible, and the obligatory year planner taking up the free wall. Wanda sat in a battered operator's chair and motioned us into the two grey stackable polyurethane seats that were the only other furniture. One thing that was missing was a computer or even a desk calculator. Instead, an old-fashioned gunmetal blue mechanical adding machine stood next to a stack of cheap ledgers, the type with carbon paper interleaves for the keeping of multiple records. I realized that we didn't actually know who or what owned the chestnut tree and its prime bit of super expensive London real estate. I put finding out on the long list I carry around in my head about two-thirds of the way down, between rust-proofing the Jag and taking Toby to the vet to get his nails clipped. Fortunately, I didn't have to fish for Wanda's background because she volunteered it up front.
"My mother was a Faloy," she said. "Do you know what a Faloy is?"
"Irish surname," said Galeed.
"That too," said Wanda.
A Faloy, according to Joseph Malzyard, in his work On the Natural Order of the Unnatural, was a creature one-half human, one-eighth unseely fey, and three-eighths seely fey. Malzyard described them as pleasant fellows in the main, albeit shiftless and prone to small mischiefs. I didn't mention this to Wanda, because it's good practice not to let on how much you know about a particular witness, and also because I know racist bollocks when I read it.
"What's a Faloy?" said Galeed. "We're a little bit of this, a little bit of that," said Wanda. "My parents were originally from Brittany,"
which explained the surname as well.
I said we were looking to check whether she'd noticed certain people visiting the pub in the last 6 months.
"This is purely for elimination purposes,"
added Galeed. I took out my official police tablet and showed her some pictures.
"That one looks familiar," she said when I showed her Jeremy Beaumont Jones. "Has he been in here?"
asked Galeed. Wanda shook her head.
"Shit," she said. "Wait, I have seen him. He was much younger. Was he a student at Oxford?"
I said he had been, but I was careful to keep it vague. Once you get them talking, witnesses like to tell you what you want to hear. It's depressingly easy to lead them astray. Just ask the inmates of any remand wing.
"I did catering at Oxford College in the early 90s, she said. "I used to do silver service jobs to pay the bills. There was plenty of work around the colleges. They always seemed to be stuffing their faces for one reason or another."
I nodded. Jeremy Beaumont Jones had been at Oxford at that time.
"I remember him because we did a couple of jobs for this dining club," she said, "and they were a bit odd, if you know what I mean."
"Scientology odd?" asked Galeed, "or My Little Pony odd?"
"Our kind of odd,"
said Wanda, making a little swirling gesture with her hand that took in all three of us. Galeed frowned at that and gave me an accusing look.
"Magic, right?" I said.
Wanda gave me a small smile and tilted her head to one side. "Or are we talking fae?" I asked, but I knew exactly who we were talking about.
"Wizard stuff," said Wanda. "You know, spells and wheels and compasses."
I rummaged around on the tablet until I found a student photograph of Jeremy Beaumont Jones that I'd lifted off his Facebook.
"Definitely him," said Wanda.
I found similarly youthful pictures of Martin Chorley and a couple of other suspected little crocodiles, but she didn't recognize any of them. She did identify a contemporary picture of Geoffrey Wheatcroft, D. Phil, former wizard, theology lecturer, and the man stupid or wicked enough to teach magic outside the formal structure of the folly.
"That's one of the things that made them unusual," said Wanda. "He was there for a lot of the gigs."
Wanda said it was important not to get carried away with mystique around the dining clubs.
It's just like your average Saturday night in Reading City Centre, only wrapped up in a ton of money, she said. Well, most of them anyway, not this lot.
Ah!
She stopped and tapped the table.
Little crocodiles, she said. That's what they were called.
And since Geoffrey Wheatcroft turned up to most of the events, that at least kept the student projectile vomiting to a minimum. Although the wandering hands were still a nuisance.
Like Greenford Disco all over again, she said.
How did you know they were doing magic?
Asked Galeed. Because people were popping off spells all through dinner, especially Lux, which, as anyone will tell you, is the first spell you learn. And there was a drinking game where each contestant conjured a werelight and then saw how many shots you could knock back while keeping it up. She didn't recognize the young Martin Chorley or Albert Price, which Wanda freely admitted didn't mean they weren't there. Silver service is hard work, and like most of the young women doing the dining club circuit, she concentrated on getting through the night with the maximum of tips and the minimum of manhandling.
But you haven't seen Jeremy Beaumont Jones since Oxford?
Asked Galeed, bringing us back to the case at hand.
No, sorry, said Wanda.
But when we showed her pics of Phoebe, Olivia and Christina, she sighed and said the last two had definitely been in. She didn't know who Christina was, but she remembered Olivia's name on account of her having to call her mum to take her away.
Why was that?
Asked Galeed.
Do you see where we are?
Asked Wanda.
Do you know what was standing here before they started hanging people behind closed doors? Do you know the real name of this place?
Tyburn,
said Galeed, who'd obviously been paying more attention to me than I thought. Because back in the days of yore, when Oxford Street was the Tyburn Road, and the city had only just started its mad rush to cover all the west in desirable red brick and stucco terraces, it was the main route out of London to the little village of Tyburn that sat just beyond where the road crossed the river. Condemned prisoners were loaded onto tumbrils at Newgate Jail and would wind their way through the streets of London past the rookeries at St. Giles before hitting the long straight road into the open countryside and the Tyburn Tree. And it was a busy place, the Tyburn Tree. Because markets were laissez-faire, every Englishman's home was his castle, and what passed for law and order was largely privately run. Back then, the gentry lived in fear of the London mob, and to keep the masses in check, made sure that stealing bread or your employer's linen was a topping offence. So they came in numbers, the tragic lads and lasses, the local boys and the immigrants from Yorkshire, Cornwall and Berkshire, from Strathclyde and County Clare. Some weeping, some defiant, and most of them pissed out of their box because the whole sad procession from Newgate Jail would make periodic pauses for refreshments.
This was the last stop, said Wanda.
A last drink under the spreading chestnut tree, perhaps a chance to unburden yourself of any secrets or things you might not be able to take into the next world. And so the chestnut tree became the repository of final bequests. Or a final offering, a tradition from back when the river ran free and its god walked amongst men. Jonathan Wilde went to the tree in the spring of 1725. I wondered whether this was where he'd left his final ledger, and if he had, was it a coincidence that Christina Chorley and Reynard Fossman happened to meet up here? Coincidence, I thought. Like fuck. So I asked about Reynard.
Oh yeah, Reynard, said Wanda. We know all about the Reynards.
We, I asked.
My family, said Wanda.
We know all about him.
Reynards, you said
Galeed.
Reynards plural.
And his family, said Wanda. From France, they're a long line of total Reynards.
And because in my line of business it pays to be sure, I asked, just so we're clear, when we're talking about a line of Reynards, are we talking multiple members of one family with the same name, or the same guy changing his identity with each generation?
Oh, he's a nasty piece of work, but he isn't that nasty,
said Wanda.
Different guys with different names. Reynards, more of a title, an appellation, a nom de bastard total.
And he's a regular here? I asked.
Well, we can't bar people for just being unsavory, can we?
Said Wanda.
We'd be out of business.
I asked who exactly would be out of business. Wanda gave me a card with her area manager's contact details and the name of the company who owned the business, Chipmunk Catering.
Not that we see that much of them, she said.
I handed the card to Ghalid, and while I asked about Reynard's comings and goings, Ghalid texted the inside inquiry office. I'd love to claim that I'd had a gut feeling about the owners, but really, it was following routine. In policing, your gut might point the way, but it's the shoe leather that catches the criminals. I showed Wanda Christina Chorley's picture again and asked if she'd ever seen her with Reynard. I used a different picture and made sure that I didn't cue Wanda that this was a repeat viewing. If you can shift the context, people often remember new facts. This time, Wanda thought it was possible that she might have seen them together, but she was hazy on the details. In just about any other pub in London, I'd have asked about CCTV footage, but me and Ghalid had noted the lack of cameras on the way in. I was going to roll the conversation back round to Olivia when Ghalid showed me her phone and the answering text from the inside inquiry office. Chipmunk Catering directly linked to County Guard. And County Guard belonged to the Faceless Man. Shit. How often do you see your area manager? I asked. Wanda said she didn't think she'd ever met him in the 3 years she'd been running the Chestnut Tree, which was entirely a good thing from her point of view. It's not like area managers ever have anything useful to say about running a pub, she said. Is it? Especially a pub like this. She had interviewed for the job here in this very room and could provide us with a name and description, but she didn't understand why. I was tempted to tell her it was just routine, but literally nobody ever believes that, even when it's true. It's part of an ongoing inquiry into property fraud, I said, which was true as far as it went. Are there any storage areas in here? Asked Ghalid. Wanda said that obviously they had food storage, dry goods, bottle storage, wine racks, and a separate cool room for those casks that needed it. Do you have any storage you've never been in? I asked. I don't know about storage as such, said Wanda, but there's a couple of rooms we don't use. You couldn't give us a look, could you? I asked. There was a corridor that was 1930s brick down one wall and 1970s breeze block on another. There were two doorways in the newer wall with cheap red doors made of medium-density fiberboard and the kind of stainless steel lever handle and lock combination that you find fitted to schools and council buildings from John O'Groats to Land's End. Wanda opened them both with one of the keys from the bunch she kept in her pocket on a hoop keyring. Inside the first were a ton of stackable polyurethane chairs, and in the second, modular steel frame storage shelves that, judging by the dust, hadn't held anything for years. See? Said Wanda, locking them back up. Nothing extraordinary at all. What about the other one? I asked. There was a third door. This one, in the old side of the corridor, and made of what looked like wooden planks. It looked suspiciously as if one of the artfully rustic tables from the saloon bar had been hauled upright and jammed into the doorway. Ah, said Wanda, looking over at the door. Yeah. She bit her lip and looked back at us. Do you have a key? Said Ghalid. I'm pretty certain we do, said Wanda, and shuffled backward a couple of steps away from the door. But I don't think I should let you open that door. I exchanged looks with Ghalid. We both knew that the words search warrant were heading for Wanda's lips, and we'd both been around enough weird bollocks to be suspicious as to why. I suggested that we make our way back up to the end of the corridor, and as we did, Wanda became noticeably calmer. She asked if we'd seen everything we wanted to. I suggested that perhaps I might borrow her keyring, just to do a security check, you know, for advice purposes, you understand. Can't be too careful, can you? Don't worry about it. It's all part of the service. Ghalid rolled her eyes, but I got the keys and Wanda got to stay at the end of the corridor where things were less likely to disturb her. I left Ghalid with her and walked back to the door carefully with all my electronic devices switched off and my tray in the upright position. After a build-up like that, the old wooden door was bound to look a bit sinister.
but even close up, I wasn't sensing anything unusual. There's a device that Nightingale calls a demon trap, a sort of magical IED, but with added animal cruelty. The Faceless Man has made use of them in the past, often to deadly effect. Just another in a long list of things that my governor would like to have a word with him about. A demon trap can be set to have a number of effects ranging from dead to really wish you were dead via spending time at the secure mental institution of your choice. Nightingale has taught me the basics of demon trap detection, the magical equivalent of carefully sliding the blade of your knife into the ground and waiting to see if it goes ting. The visual inspection divulged nothing. No circles or enclosed shapes incised into the surface of the wood. No disguised metal plates inlaid underneath. The lock itself, a heavy iron thing, revealed no intaglio or pattern when I brushed my fingertips across it. But there it was, just at the cusp of sensation. A whiff of gunmetal, and the strop, strop, strop of the straight razor against smooth leather. It was a signum I had come to recognize as belonging to the Faceless Man. It felt dusty and airless, like an old garden shed. Certainly I wasn't feeling anything that would explain Wanda's obvious psychological aversion to opening the room. Perhaps it only worked on Faye. Perhaps that's why Wanda had been employed in the first place. That part of my mind that is forever a total bastard wondered if we could recruit some Faye and map out all the places that they didn't want to go, in the interests of science and public safety. The lock was the obvious seat for any defense, so, after a moment to warn Galeed to stand clear, I sheared the hinges and, nipping up the corridor myself, knocked the door in with Impello. Normally, when I do a forced entry like that, the door twists as it pivots around the lock, but this door just fell inward with a crash and a backwash of dust. When I gingerly advanced to find out why, I saw that the lock's bolt had been cleanly sheared off level with the strike plate, with the end still inside the socket. It had already been forced, and not by me.
"Is it safe to come down yet?"
called Galeed. I told her to give us a minute while I had a look round. It wasn't that I was worried about her coming in. I was suddenly more worried about Wanda the manageress doing a runner. I pulled on my evidence gloves and went inside cautiously. Frank Caffrey, fire investigation officer, former para and folly liaison, is very clear that when entering a room you think might be rigged, the first thing you don't do is automatically reach out and flip the light switch. As he points out, that's got to be one of the cheapest and most reliable triggers an IED can have. I mean, it's even got its own power supply, he said, and he likes to point out that the Faceless Man may like his magical weapons, but he's not so stupid as to rely on them alone. You know, I used to be worried that they were going to assign me to undercover work in Operation Trident. I obviously didn't know when I was well off. It was another storeroom with metal frame variable height shelving lining the walls from floor to ceiling. About half the shelf space was occupied, mostly those at waist height for easy access. There was a thin layer of dust over the shelves and the floor. It's hard to tell with dust, but I'd spent enough time on the job with my mum to reckon a couple of months' worth. On the shelf closest to the door was a row of standard 75-litre plastic storage boxes with red clip-down lids. Their contents were a collection of angular shadows visible through the semi-transparent sides. The dust around them had been disturbed and there were clear handprints on the edges of the lids. Staying on the fallen door to avoid contaminating the floor any more than I had to, I carefully levered the lid off the nearest box and had a peek inside. It looked suspiciously like old hardback books, with stiff cloth-covered covers. The topmost book had the rough green cover I associated with the limited editions published by Russell House Press, one of the Folly's own publishing arms. I picked it up and flipped it open to the title page. It was a 1912 reprint of Merrick Casaubon's A True and Faithful Relation of What Passed for Many Years Between Dr. John Dee and Some Spirits. And yes, at the bottom, Russell House Press. A second edition. Obviously Casaubon had been popular amongst British wizards. I was willing to bet real money that Jonathan Wilde's last ledger had once languished in one of these boxes. The Merry Engine too, not to mention the genuine wizard staff and the bloody tedious Victor Bartholomew book, which begged the question why the Bartholomew had ended up on eBay and not the Casaubon. From a magical perspective, they were both about as useful, although as cures for insomnia, the Bartholomew had a slight edge. Because the Casaubon was a second edition? Carefully, I checked the other books in the box. All of them were either second editions, from the 1920s or the 30s, or had significant damage to their covers or their interior pages. I was pleased to see that even back in the glory days of the folly, people left their mugs of tea on their magical textbooks. At the bottom of the box, I found part of a map that had been ripped down its centerfold. A 1-40,000 scale depiction of a place called Ootacamund, which turned out on later research to be a British hill station in Tamil Nadu. A hill station being a place where colonial administrators and the like could use altitude to avoid the oppressive Indian summer heat, since the sensible solution, i.e. abandoning colonialism and moving back to Surrey, obviously never occurred to them. I considered checking one of the other boxes, but my mystic powers of precognition bestowed a vision upon me of a full forensic search with noddy suits and fingerprint powder and people taking their sunglasses off in a dramatic fashion. I did stop on my way out to examine the lock a bit more carefully. Again, I felt the razor strop of the faceless man's signum, and it was definitely centered on the point where the bolt was sheared right through. A hypothesis was forming in my mind. If County Guard belonged to the faceless man, then the chestnut tree did too. Perhaps it was even an asset inherited from his predecessor, which meant that, possibly, this was his storeroom, these had been his things, which had been looted by Christina Chorley and Reynard Fossman. Did they know who they'd stolen from? He was bound to be a bit miffed, I've only met him a couple of times, but he didn't seem the type to take that sort of thing with a light, forgiving heart. Which might explain why Aidan Burley's face got laminated to a tree, and what the fucker had been doing in Phoebe Beaumont Jones's basement. Looking for accomplices? Presuming he wasn't her dad. Christina and Reynard, they'd taken the stuff that looked valuable, possibly over a period of weeks. Then one day, the faceless man pops down to check on his booty, or maybe he had a burning desire to brush up on his basic thaumatology, and finds that the door is locked. Let's assume the key he's got doesn't work for some reason. He burns the lock, steps inside, and finds half his stuff's been jacked. So action one for me, fingerprint team for the corridor and the room, because nobody wears gloves all the time. Next, the faceless man's going to ask Wanda the manageress just who she's been letting into the storerooms, possibly using seducer to fog her memory. Or maybe she's a much better liar than we thought. So action two, re-interview Wanda, this time under caution plus two, which leads us on to action three, trace the rest of the chestnut tree staff and interview them as well. Rule of thumb for lowly constables. Once you're up to three actions, it's time to kick the buck upstairs. Chapter 12. The 100-meter nonchalant stroll.
"And you didn't think to try pushing the door open first?" asked Professor Postmartin.
I said nothing, mainly because he was the fourth person to ask that, after Galeed, Nightingale and Stephanopoulos. Postmartin looked remarkably dapper in his noddy suit, and was supervising approvingly as the Sockos carefully catalogued the evidence with their hoods up and their masks on. Mind you, the professor probably thought all books over 5 years old should be handled in this fashion, particularly by undergraduates. I stayed in the corridor and tried not to get fingerprint powder on my sleeves. "Have you found anything else interesting?" I asked.
"Interesting, yes," said Postmartin. "How significant, I don't know. Your hypothesis that this was the repository for the last offerings of the hanged is charming, but unsupported by the evidence so far."
"Any copies of the Principia?" I asked.
"Two, in fact," said Postmartin. "One of them quite rare."
"But physically damaged?"
"I've seen better kept copies," said Postmartin. But the marginalia in one edition is quite fascinating.
Christina Chorley and Reynard Fossman couldn't read Latin, I said. The second Principia, the Philosophiae Naturalis Principia Artis Magicis, had never been published in English, as a deliberate policy to ensure that only people of the right sort read it. They didn't recognize it for what it was. It probably just looked like a tatty old book to them.
They understood the importance of the ledger, said Postmartin.
Yeah, they did, didn't they? I said. Which implies an outside source of information, doesn't it?
I'm afraid it does,
said Postmartin and went back to his cataloguing. I found Nightingale in the manageress's office. He was leaning against the wall, arms folded, as he watched a DC from intelligence triaging the papers on the desk and packing them into evidence boxes that looked remarkably similar to those the faceless man had used to store his goodies in. I hope they didn't get them mixed up. I asked where Galeed had got to.
Finishing an interview with the manageress, said Nightingale. She seemed to think she'd get more out of the poor woman without me hovering in the doorway.
You know she's demi-fay, I said.
So Sarah explained.
You don't seem very surprised.
Nightingale shrugged. If Abdul ever gets his wish and finds a reliable...
He frowned.
What does he call it? A genetic marker?
Determining whether there was an actual genetic basis to being a fay was one of Dr. Walid's research priorities. I'm pretty certain that his keenness to employ Dr. Vaughan had come from a desire to have more time to pursue it. I confirmed that Nightingale was right, and it was indeed a genetic marker. Although, of course, it was all much more complicated than that, genetics-wise. It always is.
Should he ever find his marker, said Nightingale, and conduct his survey, I believe he will find that fairy blood is far more widespread than previously assumed.
And most of them passing, I thought, like Wanda the manageress. None of the items listed on eBay have been sold yet, I said. So they must be stored somewhere.
Indubitably, said Nightingale. I think we must assume that our tricky fox has a hideaway he hasn't told us about.
All of Reynard Fossman's last known addresses had already been searched over the weekend, as well as a few likely lockups that had, as Nightingale admitted, quite tenuous connections to the man. Not to mention that we still hadn't found the antique Renault 4 GTL that, according to the DVLA, was registered in his name. It would be nice to find the Mary engine, I said. It could be the only original difference engine in existence. We could flog it to the Science Museum.
You'd have to fight Harold for it,
said Nightingale. Postmartin took his role as archivist very seriously. But it's not a book, is it? I said. That means we get first dibs. Do you know if they made any more? Did anyone at the Folly have one?
There was always a rumour that Babbage had worked on a mechanical device of some sort for the Folly, said Nightingale. One which might have had applications in the practice, but it was just a rumour.
Was there anything about Ada Lovelace? I asked. Nightingale gave me a funny look.
Byron's daughter? He asked. I'm not sure I understand the connection.
She worked with Babbage on the difference engine, I said.
In what capacity?
She was a famously gifted mathematician, I said,
who I mostly knew about from reading steampunk, but I wasn't going to mention that.
Generally considered to have written the first true computer program.
Ah, said Nightingale. So we know who to blame.
Reynard's not going to tell us where his real lockup is, I said, and I don't think he's stupid enough to lead us to it. He must know we're going to tail him once we release him. I suppose we could still charge him with whatever we've got lying around, or ask for an extension.
No,
said Nightingale.
I think we let the fox run. But not before we inform him that the faceless man might have him in his sights.
He might bottle it there and then ask for protective custody.
So much the better, said Nightingale with a smile, because then we can extract a price for his protection. And if he doesn't, then fear might just drive him back to his den, might it not?
And if we hang him out as bait and the faceless man offs him? I asked. Nightingale put his hand on my shoulder and leaned forward.
I thought I might intervene before that happened,
he said softly, and then, straightening, said,
Besides,
It will do Reynard good to play the hound, not the fox, for a change.
I was thinking that it sounded like a fucking desperate plan to me, but Nightingale was the man who had walked home from Ettersburg and struck awe into the breasts of classically educated wizards from Herefordshire to Vladivostok.
"Do you think you can take the faceless man?"
I asked.